Welcome back to the Uncharted Podcast. This week's episode is an interview I conducted a couple of weeks ago in Austin, Texas at SaaS Open, where I had the opportunity to interview Amir, who scaled three different companies from zero to north of 150 million. And there was some amazing wisdom that we had to re-promote through this podcast. Enjoy this week's episode.
Amir started his career at IDF. After IDF, he started a cyber business as a founder. He was a co-founder for Sciota, did that for 6 years, scaled that to about 100 million, sold that to RSA. If that wasn't enough, he joined an amazing company called Actimize as the EVP and CMO. In the 2009, 2010, he became the CEO, scaled that for 4 years. During his tenure, that business 10x'd. It went from 20 million to 200 million, yep. Sold to NICE. After that, he went to a company called Sisense, which was around for about 10 years. Joins that company when they're at 10 million and scales that to about 150 million during his tenure over the 6 years he's there. And then last year he transitioned out, find a nice replaceable CEO for himself, made it profitable. And one of the first things I love asking is, you've done this now a couple of times. What gets easier the second time around as a CEO? And frankly, what gets difficult and remains difficult?
So what gets easier is the fact you have seen the movie and you kind of know what's coming. And when you get a heart attack, you don't die. Unlike the first time you get the heart attack, because you know there'll be another one and another one, and there's ups and downs. That gets easier. The network is amazing. So, you know, I can call someone that worked with me, I actually did it many times, worked with me a decade ago, and say, hey, there's the perfect opportunity for you. That gets easier. And you kind of know what to expect from yourself, people around you. So yeah, things do get easier, that's the truth. Now, what does not get easier? You still have kind of butterflies in your belly, and you know, so you still enjoy the ups and downs, and that is something that stays with you. They're less extreme, but they still exist. The second thing that is weird, the more you do it, the more you kind of want to hit fast forward sometimes, because you know exactly what needs to happen in the next 6 months, but you don't want to wait 6 months. So I would say I become more patient, but also impatient at the same time, which is a weird combination.
A tough balance. One of the reasons I was really excited, if people look at this chart, which we're going to go into, when you were at Actimize, you were selling to banks, right? $1 million yeah. deals, selling a cyber business. And I pulled a chart from the ETF Vanguard that basically shows the financial banking. If anybody remembers during the financial crisis, 2006 to 2010, it wasn't the easiest thing to sell to banks. Some of the founders right now in the audience for SaaS, right? Yep. It's getting hard. No matter what, we keep hearing no's. So you've somehow managed at Actimize to 10x the business.
You forgot the first company was at 9/11, yeah. literally in Manhattan on Broadway during 9/11. Second one, financial crisis. Yep. Third one, the SaaS crisis.
There's a lot of excuses, a lot of different things we can say. So talk to us a little bit about, like, what have you learned to push through?
I would say a few things. The first one is black swan events happen all the time. Despite their official definition, they happen all the time, especially the last few years. So if you have not had one in your current company, you will. Just the nature of life. Second one is, when you see such a crisis, declaring it as a crisis versus avoiding accepting the crisis is a really important step. So you formalize it, we're in crisis mode, let's acknowledge it and understand that life will be different tomorrow morning. And then post 9/11, our entire pipeline, it's not funny, evaporated. Like, you know, we had a lot of customers in the city, life was different and you have to accept that. You can't pretend it's not the case. In 08, our customers, the banks, just literally some disappeared. Some were under regulatory pressure. Define the crisis, accept, embrace, you know, talk about it. Thirdly, reimagine what your customers want the most right now. During 08, customers wanted one thing, which is to stay alive and not go to jail, because there was a lot of fines coming out, a lot of personal risk to the executives. During the last few years, people are cutting costs. Consolidation, cutting seats, cutting costs. Post 9/11, they wanted safety, risk reduction. So all of those things are, just accept that's the new norm, that's what people need, and if that's what they need, give it to them. So if you need to find a way to cut cost, offer how your product can consolidate and reduce cost. And if they need to de-risk, find ways to de-risk with warranties, exit clauses, whatever it is. But if you don't do that, you're dead. Like, it's not relevant. And lastly, if the crisis is going to hit your P&L, which it will, be proactive. Every minute you wait in cutting costs means that you have to cut more costs down the road. It's pure math. So be proactive, be preemptive.
Jump ahead of it. I'm going to hold my next question by giving some context to everybody. So after that, you go to Sisense. 2015, you join.
Yep.
They're doing 9 million or so. You're there a couple of years. You guys make the Cloud 100. You, 3-4 years later, raise some money from a great partner, Insight Ventures, hit 80 million, and you decide to double down on Embed. And the question I want to ask here to make it transformative for everybody, it sounds like when you hit these hiccups, you do a couple of things to elevate. And you pull a couple of levers. What did you do, Sisense, that you think the team earlier than you did not do? And more importantly, like, what's the framework you use to, you know, find out which levers to pull?
So first, every company is different. And if you get all the tips you hear on stage, ignore half of them because they're not a good fit for you. It's very contextual. At Sisense, we made 3 gigantic changes in the first few years. And they resulted in 100% growth every year. Those years. The first one is to move up market. We moved from a few $1,000 deals to what is now, you know, 100K deals. That was a conscious decision. The market for analytics is crowded. Actually, there's not many players, but there's a lot of noise in it. You have to know what you do uniquely well and focus on that. So we decided what we do well, which is complex projects, embedded projects, and moved up market to cater to those customers and not go after anything else. Say no to all the rest. So that's number one. Number two, with that, we actually moved from an inbound company, just people come to you all the time with leads, to outbound, purposeful, focused go-to-market. Because when you're in inbound, all you can do is be selective in who comes to you. But you cannot select who you go after. So we moved to outbound. Upmarket, outbound, and then the product became from a generic analytics product to a very focused, complex projects, embedded analytics. And those 3 changes really helped us differentiate, helped us improve our metrics. Less logos, worth each one way more. Cut churn, increase NDR, because it's a better fit for what you do. And with that, we then raised more money and continued to grow.
How quickly did you pull those levers?
I joined in February. In May, we had an offsite and we made the big decision.
Okay.
So. All 3 decisions. In May.
90 days.
Executing them takes time. Some can be instant, some take more time. Some people had heart attacks in the process, and that's okay. But if you don't make big moves, you don't get anywhere.
But one of the things Amiri's talked about is as you scale, as you double, as you triple, you got to reinvent the team. You got to reinvent the company. So when you join Sisense, you have had to double and reinvent. I think the hardest part about that is how do you make the decision to hire someone externally, so you have to fire someone that people love, reduce morale, versus promote from within? Like, how do you make that decision?
The pattern I found that is common to all the companies I've been involved in. If you grow really fast, every 2-3 years, you reinvent the company. It is a different company. And that accepting that is a really important thing. It's not the same company anymore. It has a different scale, different customer base, different go-to-market, different levers. With that, you usually have to reimagine the team that you have. And ideally, everyone grow with you and are perfect fit, you know, at every stage. It's never the case. If you're lucky, maybe half can make the transition and the growth. But from jack of all trades, you have to get to people that are expert in specific things, and from second level managers to third level managers and global managers. So hiring becomes really important. I really prefer to grow from within, but not at the expense of the company. So if people can make the growth and move fast, great. If not, we ever find a different role or we're not a good fit anymore. And when you hire from the outside, the mistakes I found people make is they either hire someone for 10 years from now, not relevant for where you'll be in the next 2 years. Hire someone for 24 months from today, not 6 months and not 50 months, 24 months. If it's sooner than that, it's almost a waste of a hire. And if it's much later, it's irrelevant. That's a really important thing. Number two, the cultural makeup of the company is going through a lot of stress when you grow really fast. It's really stressful for the people, the culture, you get drift of the culture slowly. So the cultural match of those hires is really important. And I can say I fucked it up a few times, so trust me, it's really important. It's something you have to focus on. And if you have to choose between skills, potential, and culture. The one thing that does not change is culture. The second thing that does not change is potential. Skills is actually the one thing that can change over time. So don't compromise on culture first. Potential is second. Skills is great, but if not, the first two are more important.
Are important. I'm going back to the last slide, which is about acquisitions.
It's like so rapid fire. I like it.
So in 2019, you decide to join with Periscope. You guys merge.
Yep.
You acquire them. There's been a couple of acquisitions in your space, right? Salesforce buys Tableau, Google buys Looker. I've been through a couple of acquisitions, three, and it's way harder. In theory, it makes sense. In practice, it's way harder. So talk to us a little bit about what was unexpected. What were the challenges? And more importantly, like what makes it successful?
So we did buy almost direct competitor named Periscope Data, great company out of California, San Francisco. And that was about a fifth to a quarter of our size from a people ARR point of view. And the reason we did that was strategic. We wanted to get closer to the data engineers and the cloud databases. I want to get into that. It's the fifth acquisition I've made. So point number one, don't do an acquisition unless you really know what you're doing. It's bloody hard and most of them fail for a reason. So don't do it. That's recommendation number one. If you decide to do it, make sure you don't fall in love with it, because with most acquisitions, once you're in the process, you can't stop. It's like dating and you cannot say no to the marriage proposal. It's really difficult. So if you're already in the process, make sure you can stop. People fall in love and are unable to undo it before it's too late. Thirdly, culture, culture, culture. Unless it's two people and no one cares, if you cannot mix the people and the operational cadence, it won't work. So that's the next one. And then make sure you do it for the right reason. If you have two companies that are not doing well, combining them will not make them better, for example, right? But some people try to do that. If you have a company with a shitty product, imagine you can replace it with a good product, it's not that easy. So just make sure you do it for the right reason. But when you do it well, it's magical. It's magical, transformative. People, technology, customer base, size, scale, momentum, market awareness, everything.
Look, you've hired some incredible people. And the reason I picked Ariel, for anybody, Ariel actually replaced Amir after you transitioned, which we'll get to. But Ariel was at Microsoft for 20 years, very, very successful. What's the secret ingredient to hiring people better than you? Talk to us a little bit about your tips.
Well, first, always hire people better than you. Otherwise, you're wasting what I imagine as a one-shot almost opportunity. How many executives can you replace a year, right? It's one of those scarce resources, so every hire is an opportunity to upgrade the talent. Second, this guy was for 15 years at Microsoft. Do not hire people in general that have been 15 years in large companies. First, I asked him to become an advisor because I was really worried that the culture would not work here, and statistically it shouldn't. So do not copy that. And he was my advisor for almost a year. That really showed me that we can work together and that he's ready and detached enough from the Microsoft best practices. Because you can be in Microsoft and successful and it will have no connection to how well you'll do in a smaller company. Literally no connection. We needed that 1 year of mutual due diligence, culturally, how he thinks, how he interacts with people that are not big company people, how he is hands-on versus hands-off. There's a lot of items here. But once we crossed that chasm, then it was an obvious match. And I'm proud to say, at that time, I hired three executives. All of them I wanted to be my successors. All three became CEOs, one of Sisense replacing me, one of another company and joined the board of Sisense, and one of a third company. So to me, that's a pretty good external validation of the caliber of people.
Love it. The next slide talks about profitability. Now it's become a little hot. The reason I picked this, and as we were preparing, you said we started actively thinking about moving towards profitability in 2021. Right?
January 21, company kickoff, I told all the employees in writing, we're going to be profitable. And I literally remember it. Someone raised their hand. Why? This was before the market crashed. So why do we need to be profitable? And I told them that we all live in this la-la land that has money is cheap, but one day it will not be. And we earned the right, scale-wise and maturity-wise, to start embarking on that journey. And by the way, it will make us better because we'll be more efficient, more focused, more refined in how we operate. The initial plan was to be profitable in 2023. We actually accelerated it and became profitable in 2022 because we started early. It was a very gradual process and not a shock to the system. It made the company better.
As you transitioned out,
yes,
you've done that now twice now, right? So I'm curious, when do you know it's time to transition out versus just needing a break?
First, I managed to burn myself out many years ago. So I've seen that movie. It is not fun, not recommended. And since then, I learned to take time off. I thought the fact that I work 20 hours a day is a great sign of success. And the fact that I work weekends and at home with the kids, I hide behind my phone. No, stupid approach, not scalable, not repetitive. So I went through it once, and I'm now actually forcing some people that work for me. Mandatory time off. There was one person, I literally told her, if you don't take time off, you're fired, because she was going to hit the wall, it was obvious. Take time off, it's okay. You're the leader of your company, you're not the most busy person of the company. And your job is to lead and think outside the box and see what's happening outside kind of the next corner, around the next corner. You cannot do that when you're just around the clock hitting emails and reply all and so on. So I am taking good breaks now, a few times a year. I'm enjoying it, life is good. The three times actually I left my business, in all of them I hit the same point that I felt like I've done my job well enough that if I go away, it will keep running.
Sure.
And by the way, the last two companies are now 300 mil each, and they're all both leaders in their space.
Good to go.
So I expect Sisense to do the same. But it reached a natural time. And definitely I felt some exhaustion after, you know, COVID especially accelerated everything. But .com, the 9/11 and the financial crisis were not better. So you feel yourself being exhausted. You feel like the company is on the good path to success. And it's also, you know, 6, 7, 8 years, it's time.
Yeah, and when you transition out, we talked about this, the identity sometimes gets stuck, right? Like you go from CEO, it's hard to transition out. You said it takes months and it takes time. Does anything help? Like any tips? Like, because a lot of these founders identify with their companies, right? Like it's hard
to
make
that distinction. I'm extremely identified with my company. Extremely, like I wear it home. All the shirts I wear, you know, have the company brands. And my kids have like all the swag and everything. It's very difficult because you identify with the company. What I would say that was I had two really big moments. The first one when I threw a lot of swag, which was really hard to kind of let go. I kept like one each, but that's it. And the second one when I stopped having phantom pain looking for emails, like I would hit the email and nothing would come up. Those were like two real moments. But it's not easy. It's many, many months until you really feel like it's a distant relative and, you know, your number one child.
100%. Well, everybody, thanks for joining us. And everybody, let's give it up for Amir.